Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are the world's dictators getting better at keeping power to themselves, even as they appear to respond to their people's calls for autonomy and information? The Arab Spring raised hopes around the world for the spread of democracy, but even the removal of dictators in Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia has not guaranteed real and significant rights for the people who suffered under their leadership. And in other authoritarian states, leaders have made small concessions to individual liberties, mostly as a method for bolstering their own omnipotence over political matters. So how have repressive states modernized so quickly, and what can opposition groups yearning for democracy do to keep up and hopefully surpass the influence of their autocratic governments? William J. Dobson is politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. His new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Will, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Many observers have been excited to see this growing demand for democracy in different parts of the world, really since the breakup of the Soviet Union. Your assessment is that there has actually been a sort of reversal in recent years, so that dictators are strengthening their hold on power. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. If you go back in time a little bit, if you go back to all the way, in fact, to, say, 1974, at that point in time, that was sort of like a very low point for democracy in the world. There were only 41 democracies in the world at that moment. And then when you fast forward up to the fall of the Soviet Union, when it broke apart, the number of democracies in the world, we had seen a real uptick. And so we're now at that point in time looking at 76 democracies. And those trends were positive and progressive, and they continued. And they continued all the way to 2005. And at that point in time, there had been a tripling of the number of democracies in the world from 1974. But that's really a dividing line, because from 2005 on, we've seen a decline in political freedom around the world each year. And that's the first time that's happened in this entire 40-year period that I'm basically describing. So part of the purpose behind my book was to really go out, and I went to all these countries to try to understand what was going on. And what I found, and what we can talk more about, is that indeed these dictators and authoritarians are far more sophisticated, savvy, and nimble than we've often given them credit for being.
Yeah, certainly the problem is not that fewer citizens crave democracy, but that the nature of authoritarian rule has evolved. In many cases, it is less physically brutal, but no less as powerful.
That's precisely right. The modern, because it's also fair to say, and we've seen evidence of it in this past year, it's never been harder to be a dictator. I mean, I think it's important to point that out. I mean, once upon a time, you could engage in mass arrests, firing squads, disappearances, and really your crimes would go uncovered for a long time if they were ever found out entirely. I mean, Stalin sent millions to the gulag. That's sort of the classic example from the last century. And that's really impossible to do in the shadows now, because there are no shadows. And so the dictator of today, a modern dictator, has to understand that everything he tries to do will be under a spotlight. And so those that are sharpest, those that are most sophisticated, understand that in a globalized world, the more brutal forms of intimidation, those mass arrests and firing squads and what have you, violent crackdowns, are best replaced with subtle forms of coercion. So what we see in places like Russia, Venezuela, China, and elsewhere is usually the use of almost legalistic means to accomplish their ends. So Vladimir Putin, for example, will deploy tax collectors or health inspectors to shut down a dissident group. In Venezuela, laws are going to be written very broadly, but they're not applied that way. They're applied very selectively against those people that the government views as a threat. And so we see that they're much more precise, and they go through the motions. Indeed, they will talk about democracy. They will install human rights organizations and oversight groups. But even though they're the ones really perpetuating the crimes, and this is all really an attempt to sort of refurbish what they do to make it somehow seem acceptable.
Yeah, over and over as I read this book, Will, in my notes, I kept writing down the phrase thin veneer of democracy, because that's really all it is. They know they have to talk about it, but they also realize they don't have to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and you could say, okay, so we're talking about the construction of facades. And facades are useful because, you know, they do obscure. But what these regimes are doing today even goes beyond that, really, because, you know, if you go back in time, you know, you think about maybe like the classic totalitarian regime from the Cold War era was East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
What was East Germany, really? What did it call itself? It was the German Democratic Republic. I mean, as long as there have been dictatorships, they've been calling themselves by words and labels that are actually would sound totally acceptable to us, Democratic Republic. They were anything but. And that was something everyone knew. I mean, this wasn't incredibly sophisticated. It was just a different label. But this isn't just labels. I mean, what we find in these countries is an architecture. They are creating systems and institutions that actually help make up for the downside or costs of centralizing power.
Hmm.
So, for example, a very quick, simple example is in Russia, for example, Putin has made the parliament a rubber stamp parliament.
Right.
So he gets nothing from it. I mean, in terms of just blanket support, but he doesn't really learn anything from it. And that's what a legislature is supposed to do. Your legislature is closer to people than their central government. And so when you put forward an idea, the first people to tell you it's a bad idea or to give you feedback of any kind is often the legislature. Well, he won't get that there because these are all yes men.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he knows that's a problem. And that's the difference. He goes further and says, okay, then I'll create a new institution. And I'll put people in that institution that are actually even critical of me, who are experts in their fields, in media, and law, and human rights even. And when I put forward an idea, those people will give me feedback. I will learn why the idea doesn't work, and I'll be able to hone it. But those people will also have no power to vote or in any way impinge on my ability to act. So that way, he gets the best of both worlds, or at least he's trying to, of having that information, getting what a democratic institution would have provided him, but keeping it from actually having any leverage over him himself.
Yeah, it's like an evil sort of market research.
Yeah, you could say that. And I met the man, I went and interviewed the man who came up with the idea. He was one of Putin's chief advisors during the entire time. He's now out of power because and no longer advising Putin because he believed that Medvedev should have come back for another term. And that was, in fact, you know, not in keeping with what Putin's own desire was. And so he was pushed aside. But this man was crucial in creating the architecture that we see in that regime now.
So you have Putin in Russia, you have Chavez in Venezuela. In China, it's not so much about an individual as about the supremacy of the Chinese Communist Party. And the strategy there to sort of liberalize is a little bit different, but equally effective, it turns out. The Chinese Communist Party has said to local officials, do what you can for people, fill their needs, provide some services. That way, no one will question the ruling at the top.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, China is an incredible case because it is really the example of a regime that was pushed up against the brink and had so much go the wrong way for it, but has bounced back in a way that no one could have truly anticipated. I mean, if we were all honest and went back to 1989,
yeah,
we would never say that this is a country that has a long future, this ruling party has a long future. They had Tiananmen Square happening just there, and this wasn't just protests in Beijing. Those were protests all around the country. But on top of that, it lost the Soviet Union at that same moment, and with it, most of its diplomatic allies in the Eastern Bloc. It seemed incredibly isolated. Its own party had divisions within it because there were people in the party that were actually sympathetic to the students in the square. So this was a true crisis point for the party. Now look at it now. And so how did that happen? Maybe it's because the regime didn't turn inward. It didn't become a police state. In fact, it opened up further. It was already on the path of opening, but it pushed it further. And it essentially changed the social compact with its people, where they said, look, and as you just said, look, we will no longer inquire into your personal beliefs. We will give you a certain measure of freedom. We're not going to make you free, but freer. And in exchange, you don't question our monopoly on political power. And you might prosper. You might do very well, in fact. But it all requires this one price. And so they go. And a lot of that was really informed not by just guesswork. They sent researchers to the Eastern Bloc countries, to the former Soviet Union, to study and examine what they had done wrong, learn those lessons, and then come back and make sure they didn't repeat them.
There are also examples of dictatorships paying attention to what we would consider true democracies like the United States, looking at Western governments and how they communicate with their own people and taking that language and applying it back at home.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, you know, you find that these these regimes are very good at speaking the language of human rights. I mean, one of the sort of, you know, incredible innovations, which I think, you know, a lot of people aren't familiar with, is we think of NGOs in the civil society space as being one where you really get pressure on the government to move in a more progressive fashion. These are sort of, in our own country, places which often act as watchdogs and monitor what people in political power are trying to do, and then when they go afoul, let everyone know. Well, if that's the case, then in a lot of these countries, they have NGOs that perform this role, except for they're actually working for the government. So the correct term to call them is gongos, not NGOs, government-operated NGOs or gongos. And that's what they do. They essentially, they are there to provide, to make, to appear, and they will have names like the Human Rights Organization, the Human Rights Fund, what have you. They are there primarily, one, to say, well, look, we know we have problems in our country, but we're making progress. And so they're subtle apologists for the regime. They also, they confuse the media. So people actually think that they're getting quotes from people that are critical of the government when, in fact, they're being paid by them. And then that's a third and important element, which is that they soak up funding from groups in the United States and the United Nations who are giving them money thinking that they're giving it to a worthy organization when, in fact, it's keeping that money from going to the actual legitimate NGO that is probably somewhere else down the street.
Let's talk about how elections work in so-called modern dictatorships, because it used to be that they could come back and the next morning say, we have won by 99.9%. And they realize now not only do they not have to do that, but in fact, there might be some advantage to stuffing only 70% of the ballot boxes with their own candidates' names.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you see it again and again that the modern dictator understands that there's really no value. There's zero value in saying that 100% or 99% of the people voted for you, because everyone knows it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So why go through it? I mean, that's a good example of a worthless facade. You know, no one is really that stupid. And so they want to win, and they want to win with a mandate, but they understand that they should stop clear of that. So why? I mean, one, it makes the election itself seem somewhat legitimate. It also, you know, we were talking about there are opposition parties that are in these countries competing against the ruling party, and that's useful in itself, because in having an opposition party, it actually soaks up some of the dissent from people who are unhappy with the regime, and that leads, you know, look, if you have a party that you can support that you think is against the ruling party, and you're able to go out and rally for them and whatnot, well, at least you feel like you're participating in the system. You're less likely to turn out for a riot or you know, to engage in anti-government activity, because you believe that there is a role for you and an opposition in the country, even though, again, it's a farce. And then, you know, ultimately, really, you know, the most sophisticated type of election engineering, I guess you could say, is going on in a place like Venezuela, which truly sort of resets the bar.
Yeah, it's really stunning what's taking place there. There are election records kept that include names attached to people that individuals voted for.
Yeah, I mean, this happened, began to happen more than 5 years ago, and there are different lists of people's voting behavior, which the government collected, and then it released them onto websites under the claim that they were putting it onto the websites in order to validate whether or not the signatures people had signed on various referendums were in fact legitimate. But it had an opposite effect, which is that once that information was made public, then it could be easily downloaded onto compact discs, and then it was disseminated everywhere. And you know, the big example of this was something called the MySanta.
Let me jump in here, Will, because
sure,
we need to take a break, and I want to be able to get the whole story there. My guest is William J. Dobson. He's politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate and author of the new book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. If you would like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Slate Politics and Foreign Affairs editor William J. Dobson. His new book is called The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org. Well, before the break, you were starting to tell us about this element of Venezuelan election records keeping called Maysanta.
Yes, that's right. And so, you know, the Maysanta essentially was a collection of people's names, addresses, and voting behavior over a number of recent referendums. And it was ultimately distributed, this information, on compact discs around the country. And you know, it was a very potent weapon because, as an opposition politician told me, she said, you know, fear does not leave fingerprints. Hmm. And her point was just simply that once this information is widely disseminated in a politically polarized environment like that, it could be used, and it has been used, to deny people health care, to keep people from getting promotions, to keep them from getting passports, or to ensure that they were audited. And this information is everywhere. I was standing on a street corner in Caracas, and someone came up to sell me what I thought were knockoff Hollywood DVDs. It was a copy of the Maysanta. For $1.50, I had voting information on millions of Venezuelans.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about Egypt here. This has been a fascinating case study in the sense that removing a corrupt individual leader does not guarantee that a better government will absolutely fill that void.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the key thing to understand here is, in looking at Egypt and what's going on right now, is you need to understand sort of what the moment was before the so-called revolution of last year. I mean, if there was a way to describe what Mubarak's regime was, the most accurate explanation or term or label would be a military dictatorship. And that's because, really, unlike any of the other authoritarian countries I visited for this book, the military in Egypt is really a peerless institution. All modern Egyptian presidents have been from the military. The military is really the only institution in the country that actually functions, that really works well. While all government services were sort of falling into disrepair, the military remained fairly professional. And so what happened in that moment before the people rose up is that there had been a conversation going on for about 5 years about who would follow Mubarak, and it was believed to be either his son, which really would have been unprecedented even for Egypt. I mean, there were no family dynasties in the modern era. Again, everyone came from the military. The logical presumption was that the next leader would come from the military. Mm-hmm. And so when the people rose up, it wasn't necessarily a revolution, as I see it. I mean, really what happened is it was succession. The military took advantage of this moment in order to answer the question of who would come next by saying, if we will steer this process forward, don't worry. Well, there's been a lot to worry about since then, because they've clearly had their finger on the scales. And now we find a country where, you know, right before, as the Egyptian people were going to vote yesterday, they issued an interim constitution, which essentially ensured that they will continue to have power at precisely the moment they were supposed to hand it over to the civilians. Hmm. All this is really, though, very predictable if you think about what was there before Mubarak fell.
But, you know, when Mubarak started in 1981, indications were that he might, in fact, be truly less corrupt than what had come before, and that, in fact, he was interested in opening up the government.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, but what we have in Mubarak when he becomes president, you know, with the shocking assassination of Sadat, we have a very politically inexperienced man being thrown into the presidency mm-hmm. at that moment. And he, you know, why had Sadat even chosen him? He'd chosen him because he was believed to be a man of no ambition. He was seemed to be a safe choice. There were meetings that Kissinger had attended with Sadat where he recounts that he thought, he had no idea that the man sitting in that part of the room was the vice president. He thought he was an intern.
Wow.
I mean, this is who he was. And so if you can imagine, and I'm afraid we may never truly know, but if you can imagine him being sort of thrust into this role, he was buying himself time. He was learning how he was going to somehow steer this ship, and he did go through, you know, a number of measures and reforms in those early years that were meant to sort of really show him as being a different type of leader as Sadat. But in fact, you know, he never did install a vice president. He never relieved the emergency law, which was put in place. He kept it until the very end, and he became the man we now know him to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I'd just like to keep in mind Jesus' little warning to look at the log in your own eye rather than pointing at the flaws in others. And we've got other issues. It's impossible to get elected without having lots of money. These think tanks are all run by contributions from billionaires. They all seem to have the same point. I mean, you have liberal interventionists on the left side, and you've got neocons on the right, but there's no peace camp because there's no money in it. There's not a single law or writ that's passed in this country without it benefiting some big donor. And I just think we have all these same problems ourselves. People thought they were electing Obama to end the wars, and he's escalated them. Where's all this choice in democracy here? Because it's ultimately, the Arab Spring has shown is that all countries are ruled by the consent of the governed. Egypt's not done, and the people are going to keep that place in chaos until the military.
You're breaking up there a little bit, Thomas, but I think we have the gist of your remarks and a little outside of what we're talking about this afternoon. But, well, maybe this research did make you look at domestic issues with a more critical eye.
There's no question. I mean, and this is not a book about the United States, but, you know, the caller raises absolutely, you know, legitimate questions. And I would think that, you know, there's one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that, you know, this isn't. These issues may seem like they're foreign issues, but they're not necessarily foreign issues. Russia may have had an imperfect democracy during the 1990s, but it was functionally democratic, and it was really short-lived. Mm-hmm. In the same case, in Venezuela was a leading democratic country in South America in South America's oldest democracy, I should point out, and had a functioning modern democracy for 40 years. And that was all before Chavez. So, you know, we like to imagine that somehow these countries sort of exist in certain boxes. And that's really not the right way to imagine it. We are all on a pendulum. And the politics and the democracy that we have is a result of what we do to earn it. And, if nothing else, I agree with the caller and to say that if there's something about your politics or your democracy that concerns you, you have to protect it because no one else will. That much I agree with.
Let's talk about control of information and the media, because the place we think of when we think about complete lack of access to information from the outside world is, say, North Korea. But again, modern dictators are learning you don't have to be all that blunt. You can, in fact, go in with a pretty precise scalpel and remove the things that might not work for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fantastic study that just came out this past week. I finished writing my book, more than 6 months ago, so I don't mention it in the book, but I can mention it here. I mean, there was a study that just came out last week that was looking at sort of the use of social media control in China, and what they found was that, in fact, the government wasn't necessarily more likely to crack down on dissent or criticism of the government. That was something that they're actually fairly permissive of online. But where they draw the line is where they see these people or groups working together to try to organize around those ideas. And that is completely consistent with what you see in sort of the political realm. You have, estimates of about 500 protests in China every day. That's not probably welcomed by the government, but they don't see it necessarily as their undoing. What's critical is that the group protesting in one place is not able to link up and coordinate its activity with a group in another place. And so you have these sort of fine lines, and you say, okay, this is the line that we're not willing to cross. All these countries have a degree of a free press. And that's because there's a value in having a free press that even a dictator can recognize. Because, if you're at the top of a highly centralized and what you know to be a corrupt system, how are you supposed to find out who is going too far, where the corruption lies in all cases? Because you don't know of all the corruption, and some of it is probably even worrisome to you as the leader of this country or the leader of the ruling party. And so a little bit of a free press can actually give you good information, which is one of the chief concerns of an authoritarian regime, is that they're not getting good information because no one has the right incentives to tell them the truth. And so you let there be a little bit, a safety valve, if you will, of a free press, but you keep it in print. You keep it in small circulation newspapers and things like that. Then you get, again, striving to get the best of both worlds.
Talk a little bit about your observations in China, because the criticism has been leveled by some analysts that many Chinese people have sort of traded any desire for democracy in exchange for this greater economic prosperity that theoretically this more open China allows them.
Well, I mean, I think that is the case. I mean, I think, you know, it's a difficult thing for people that are coming out of the history that China has experienced in, say, the last 40 years to turn your nose at the opportunity to, you know, better the quality of life and lifestyle of your family. And that's what they see here. I mean, I don't think it's not a normal thing. It's not a typical thing for people to rise up against an injustice and fight for it just because it's the right thing to do. I mean, generally, all of us are most interested in trying to take care of our own. And so I think that's what you see happening there. And that's what makes it so remarkable when people do take on these really incredible dangers, these incredible personal risks. And I have to tell you, I mean, I traveled to Venezuela and Russia and China and Egypt and Malaysia and other places. And in all these places, when you meet these people, these opponents of the regime, you're not meeting starry-eyed romantics. Mm-hmm. The people I met were really incredible tacticians. These were people, and you'd have to be on some level, because the romantics don't last very long in this fight.
Yeah.
You know, they have a short shelf life, whereas these people who are really in the trenches are thinking incredibly strategically, and they come from all walks of life. And those people are very much in China too, but they're working in an environment that can be brutally repressive when it locates you.
Can you talk about the influence you've seen of the American scholar Gene Sharp on these pro-democracy movements?
Well, there's almost nowhere I went where his ideas and work wasn't familiar with at least some groups active in trying to fight dictatorships. And for those who aren't familiar with him, I mean, Dr. Sharp is a researcher at Harvard, and he's considered really the father of strategic thinking around nonviolent conflict, nonviolent struggle. And he has spent really his entire lifetime studying the work of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others. And this is not pacifism, and that's a really an important thing to underscore. This is thinking strategically about how to undo an authoritarian regime nonviolently. And that really, we've seen evidence of this in Egypt most recently, but there was nonviolent revolutions that came about in Georgia, that came about in Ukraine, that came about in the Philippines in the 1980s, and there's so many more examples. And so his ideas, you know, really have moved the most around the world since the Internet has become much more widespread. His work is downloaded everywhere. And he ultimately, you know, wrote some much smaller versions of his books can run to the thousands of pages. He wrote, you know, a concise version that's roughly 90 pages because he wanted to give them something that they could digest and try to put to use. It's not a blueprint, but it's a way of thinking about how you can adjust these strategies to your own environment, your own context.
How important is it for pro-democracy activists to cultivate support from within, say, the police departments and the military ranks and groups that might otherwise be expected to stand in their way, if not to crush them entirely?
It's crucial. I mean, there was one activist that was instrumental in overthrowing Slobodan Milosevic in 2000 in Serbia, and this was at the time he was 26 years old, and now he works for an organization that he founded that goes around the world trying to help people do the same in their own authoritarian countries. And he likes to say that spontaneity will get you killed. And so when we turn on CNN and we see these protests in Tahrir or wherever we might be watching these people pour out into the streets, it looks to us to be as if sort of a magical act, as if all of a sudden something sort of snapped and everyone sort of came to and said, okay, let's take the palace.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. These things are planned. There's a lot of work and much of it tedious that goes into place well in advance. And one of those is one that you just mentioned, which is that, you know, it's much less likely for generals and police to fire into a crowd of people when they know that their own children are in the front ranks.
Hmm.
And so these movements will recruit their children to be sure that they are part of the movement. They will reach out and they will find, you know, we imagine the police as being some sort of monolithic group. They're not. They're people, you know, in those uniforms who are fathers, who are, you know, husbands, uncles, what have you. And they try to reach out to them as such. I mean, one really powerful example is what do you do about the person who is particularly abusive and enjoys to beat up, you know, the students in the street? What they did in Serbia was they took his photograph while he was beating young people up, and they made posters of him, and they put his cell phone on that poster, and they plastered the posters where his wife shopped. Because they knew, we can't convince him, we can't persuade him, but his wife will persuade him. When we shame him, when we put the posters up on the pathway that his wife takes his children to school in the morning, and then his phone will ring, her phone will ring, and the power of the community will be such to make him stop. And it's thinking in that way, very creatively and differently, that you're able to push people, pull people in the direction that you want, which is less violence and at least to put down the batons.
Yeah, what's so astonishing is that we think of these things, as you mentioned, sort of taking place on this scale of thousands of people, but it really comes down to being successful when you think of it on a human-by-human scale.
That's right. I mean, that is a very large part of it. At the end of the day, you have two groups that are competing here. You have the loyalists to the regime, and you have the people who have defined themselves by their opposition to the regime. Well, at the end of the day, when you add up all those people on those two sides, that's not very many people. Most of the people are in the vast middle. And what you're doing, what each side is doing, is trying to compete for their loyalty, for their sympathy, for their allegiance. And that's why, what is the first thing we've seen from all of these regimes when a revolution breaks out? They try to cast the revolutionaries as militants, as drug dealers or what have you. And that's because they're trying to convince the middle class that they're not you. It's all part of the war.
William J. Dobson is here. He's politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. His new book is called The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William J. Dobson. He's politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate and author of the new book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. There are also interesting examples here, Will, of demonstrators using humor to sort of win those hearts and minds of the great undecided middle who really ultimately are just trying to sort of live their lives and survive and prosper for their own families. Can you talk about some examples of that?
Sure, absolutely. Humor is an incredibly useful tool, particularly if you're working in this environment that is trying not to be too repressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when someone is yelling at you and you respond with humor, it's very hard for the other side to know what to do or know how to react. And so some of the best examples come out of Venezuela. The Venezuelan student movement is really the only political player in Venezuela that's ever successfully defeated Chavez in any of his electoral contests. And this happened a few years ago when they were holding one of the many referendums that have been there. And what the students did is they found ways to communicate with the population that they would understand that was sometimes not even political. And so one that I liked a lot was that, you know, I interviewed the Venezuelan students who were part of that movement, and they said, you know, here in Venezuela, we are very proud of the fact that we produce so many Miss Universes. Miss Venezuela is a hero to us. Mm-hmm. And it's something we just, it means a lot to us, and just, it just does. And so what we, you know, when we were trying to explain to the Venezuelan voter what Chavez was really trying to do, we said, okay, imagine this. Imagine that Miss Venezuela was the same person every year. And so they produced these posters of an aged-looking Miss Venezuela and said, that's what he wants. He wants to be president for life. You couldn't possibly want that. And that's the type of thing that sort of makes, you know, light bulbs go off for people and say, wait a minute, I see what you mean. That is kind of crazy. That is ludicrous. Why would we do that? In Serbia, to draw another example there, you know, everyone knew that Milosevic's wife really liked to wear a flower, a white flower in her hair.
Right.
And so they put white carnations on turkeys, and then they released the turkeys in downtown areas where the police then were forced to try to herd these birds. And apparently in Serbia, calling a woman a turkey is about the worst thing you can possibly do. And it would not have been lost on anyone that a turkey with a white flower on its head was a reference to Milosevic's wife. And basically, who was the target of that? The target of that was the police themselves. Because if you're a police officer, you will grow very resentful of a government that makes you chase turkeys and makes you look like a fool in public so often. And they would always be there with their cameras and alert the media in advance so that you could be sure that a lot of this would show up on the 6 o'clock news.
How aware, Will, are these pro-democracy activists of the danger of focusing on removing one individual at the expense of really reforming the entire system that allowed that individual to rise?
It's a concern. I mean, I think there's no question that it's a concern. And I think that they look at it a few different ways. I mean, one, that's why it's very important that a component of their work be educating the whole population about what is truly needed. And it's not necessarily about removing one person. I mean, and again, to draw from the Venezuelan case, they never actually used Chavez's name because they didn't want to personalize it and make it seem as though it was all about Chavez, because that would sort of just feed into the rhetorical strategy that Chavez has always had, which was to try to very much personalize the war of words between himself and his opponents and to label them as fascists or sons of the empire or whatever.
And portray himself as a victim, therefore.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. So, they really want to make it not about you, it's about the system. So that's one element. But there's another element, which is just the reality, which is that, and I think this is the case in Egypt, I'm pessimistic on what was accomplished a year ago,
mm-hmm.
Because for the reasons I already said, that I think that it was in more ways succession than it was revolution. But I don't fault the people that rose up. Any democratic path for that country involves the steps that they just took. You had to get Mubarak out of the picture before you could even have the conversation they're having now. You shouldn't be fooled into believing that you've won the day. Rather, you have to understand that your work has just begun. But I didn't meet a single young person in Tahrir Square who didn't understand that fact.
Let me ask you this, and this might seem like an overly simplistic question, but is it your sense that the dictators of the world recognize themselves for what they are, regardless of what they tell people? Or do you think they go to bed at night thinking that they are really as good as they would claim?
That's not a simplistic question. That's a tough question, because I don't know. That's a really, what a wonderful question. I wish I knew the answer, because I think that on some level, if you look at what they engage in, that it's so deliberate. It's so careful, it's so manicured and cultivated, the system that they're trying to maintain, that there is no question a degree of intentionality to it and foresight that really suggests that they understand the game that they're playing. But at the same time, I do think they commonly, you know, again and again, they make the same mistake, which is having created this architecture, having created this system, they forget its lessons and they begin to believe their own lies. And I think that that's a common mistake that I think you saw it in Egypt, and I think you saw it in Russia. I mean, I think Vladimir Putin is one of the best modern dictators we have in the sense that he's effective at what he's trying to do, but he did make a number of missteps last year that really provoked the tens of thousands of people that went out into the streets. And you know, to that, I think he probably recognizes his mistake, and that's why he's recovered the way he has. They, at the end of the day, these are people, and I do believe that it's hard for anyone to be at the center of a system like this and at some point not begin to believe the mythology.
Aside from perhaps the over-discussed element of social media that has been used over the past couple of years, how else do you find pro-democracy activists using technology in new ways to further their cause?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the technology itself is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And the regimes are very effective at using it as well. And so what we have here is, you know, a question of who can use the technology best, who is, you know, sort of swiftest and most agile in it. And the regimes are generally not as innovative as the protesters, but they catch on fast. So what does that mean then? It means that these technologies are just something that they're wielding. And at the end of the day, the political strategies, the communication strategies, these other sort of, if you will, old school elements of protest and resistance, public resistance, are what really matter the most. And so, because the technology will change, and Facebook has become not just a good way of spreading your message, but it's also become a good way for the government to find out who you are and to locate your network. One misplaced cell phone can reveal all of your contacts in a way that, you know, no government could have ever hoped to undermine a movement so quickly before, when everything was burned and kept on paper.
Of the places that you focused on for the book, Venezuela, Malaysia, Egypt, Russia, China, was there one country that stood out in terms of people's willingness and openness to meet with you, a journalist, and talk to you about what they were doing?
You know, it was something I was obviously concerned about. And, you know, in general, I found people, you know, and this is just sort of a truth in life, is that when you contact someone, even someone who works for a dictator, and you say, I'm interested in what you do and I'd like to hear more about it, seven times out of ten, they'll say, when do you want to get together? When do you want to meet? Let's have coffee. And so, in general, it was very surprising to me how open people were on both sides. From the point of view of the people who were taking these enormous risks, my chief concern was just their own security. I was very surprised to find that, in general, they always wanted me to use their name. They always wanted me to draw attention to their cause. And if they had any impatience with me whatsoever, it was just that writing a book like this takes a while, and they wanted it out, you know, yesterday. And that was because they believe, and I think they know better than I to know what's correct. They believe that as much attention as they get, the better, because the crime's worst deeds are committed in the shadows. And so they want to be spotlighted. They want people to know their name so that it becomes harder for the regime to move against them. They're still going to be worried about quote-unquote accidents that might happen. But, you know, they see this, in the end, given what they're trying to do, as important. And so they freely would give their names. Whereas people in the regimes, they were often more likely to request anonymity, because they know that if they say the wrong thing or they're portrayed in the wrong way, that it could be costly for them. And so I thought that was quite interesting, that in fact the people that you would appear to be in the safest position in the society, the ideologues, political advisors and whatnot around a regime, were the ones that were often most fearful.
So as you noted earlier, you started to observe the sort of backslide in democracy in the middle part of the last decade, and you've been actively reporting on this since 2009. How did the events of late 2010 and 2011 affect the progress of what you were putting down on paper?
Well, it meant a lot more work. you know, that's the, you know, I you know, not, you know, at the end of the day, I think the book is coming out, you know, came out 2 weeks ago. I think it came out roughly, I want to say, maybe 8 months, 9 months later than I anticipated it would. And that was because I had to get back to Egypt right away. You know, what ended up, the conversations, I had been to Egypt in 2006, and then, you know, really before I really started working on this project in earnest, but I had an inkling of the idea, and so I was doing interviews even then. And then in 2010, I met with people around Mubarak, and, you know, at that point in time, you know, they were fully confident in the project that they were a part of. And they spoke to me rather candidly, and what that ends up being in the book is really a time capsule of what a regime was thinking and what they thought they had accomplished when they were actually on the precipice. when they were actually about to be pushed, and they had no idea. And so, you know, I went back again in 2011 because I wanted to meet, well, I wanted to try to meet with them. Most of them had run and could no longer be found. And I wanted to meet with the activists who, when I met with them in 2010, it was always in hushed voices, in cafes where they never had their back to the door. And now these were, you know, some of the proudest and and happiest people I'd ever seen in my life. And you know, and I will say it again and again and again, in all these countries, when I would leave with the feeling that I would not want these people, these activists, these, you know, really incredibly brave people, to be my opponent.
Mm-hmm.
You almost begin to feel a little bit bad for these regimes because you think, you know, you have no idea what you're up against. These people are resilient. And so I found that over the course of this project, over the course of these years, really from 2009, as you say, to now, I became more and more optimistic about the prospects. The challenge is real, but I really believe that these people are the people that should be fighting it.
It's an interesting balancing act that you face here, and that I suppose that we all face if we care about these issues, because on the one hand, you are optimistic about the potential for the spread of democracy. On the other hand, you still feel like in many cases the dictators are winning, and your premise in the book didn't change after 2011 necessarily.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, this is really, you know, in some ways we imagine these issues a lot of times as sort of conflicts between states. And what really came through for me was that this is a battle between people within countries. And, you know, I think that, you know, what we're looking at is something that's not going to be settled quickly. It's going to take time. But, you know, the regimes are quite capable. And there's a reason why we see sort of the macro trends that we've seen in the last few years that, you know, I cite from 2005 to now. But internally, these regimes are being tested in ways that they've never been tested before. And so, on the one hand, we have to be realistic. I mean, we have to understand that these things are going to take time. But I really do think that the regimes themselves are just finding that their work is getting more and more and more difficult with time. And we see a country like Burma now, which, I mean, that's a fascinating example of a regime that in no time at all, in just a matter of really we're talking about months still, has decided that it needs to try to, what I'd say, walk up the dictator's learning curve and try to open itself up, because they understand that being the isolated pariah state that they've been for so long is getting them nowhere. And I think in part of that, that's a lesson that they draw from watching the events in the Arab Spring. And they say to themselves, we either do this and succeed, or we die, you know, as a pariah regime that has no chance, and it's just not worth it. So they take the risk, and we'll see what happens.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but you mentioned earlier that pro-democracy activists are learning from their comrades in other countries. It sounds like dictators are doing the same thing.
That's exactly right. I mean, all sides are learning. This is a problem, an issue with a thousand dimensions, and they are paying attention to each other. And I found that even with the end of my reporting in 2011, where there were Egyptian officials who said, I wish we'd responded differently. I wish we'd done what had been done in Libya and whatnot. Mm. Of course, that was no solution. That was no salvation for Gaddafi either. And I don't think it will be for someone like Bashar Assad in Syria.
William J. Dobson is politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. His new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Well, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer, and today he also answered the phones. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got any comments, questions, or suggestions, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.